Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. Your friends may be more important than your genes in determining whether you gain weight, according to a recent study. The study followed a large group of Americans for more than three decades, and it was the first to demonstrate that obesity and perhaps other health problems that involve behavior or lifestyle spreads through social networks. Persons' chances of becoming obese were found to increase by more than half, 57%, if someone he considers a friend becomes obese, 40% if he or she has a sibling or becomes obese, and 37% if his spouse becomes obese. Immediate neighbors who aren't friends were found to have no effect on obesity, which lends support to the notion that one person is influencing the behavior of the other rather than that both share a common exposure, such as socioeconomic class or lack of stores selling healthy food. We're going to talk about all of this with Barbara Rolls, who is a PhD, professor, and Guthrie Chair of Nutrition at Penn State University, past president of the Obesity Society, has served on the advisory council of the National Institutes of Health's Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. She is the author of Volumetrics, three professional books on food and nutrition, and numerous academic articles. And we thank Dr. Rolls for being with us today. Thanks very much for joining in.
My pleasure, Jim. Thank you.
When you saw that report in the New England Journal of Medicine, what were your thoughts as you read along?
Well, it's not really that surprising to me. I do studies that are conducted in the lab and follow that line of research. And we've known for some time that eating with friends, you end up eating more than if you're eating alone or with strangers. We first found that back in 1991, and there have since then been a number of studies demonstrating that. So this is just notching it up in looking at the whole society and obesity. But we have known for a while that you eat what your friends are eating. And also you look at what other people around you are eating. So there are a number of studies where they'll send in an experimenter who will overeat, and the people in the test don't know this, and they'll end up following what the proxy person is eating.
Are you acquainted with Dr. Nicholas Christakis?
No.
He is the...
Yes, he and Dr. Fowler are the authors at Harvard.
Right, that of this research. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that in a column from Ellen Goodman, the columnist, the national columnist, that Dr. Christakis has now responded to more than 1,000 emails explaining mm-hmm. today that he doesn't believe the first step to weight loss is cutting your friends out of the menu.
No, that's a little tough, isn't it? And especially since you could potentially influence your friends in a positive way and influence them to eat a healthier diet and maybe even to lose weight. So that's the optimistic part of this study, is that it can work both ways. So sure, you can overeat because your friends are overeating, but maybe you can eat a healthier diet and eat fewer calories if they do that and set the example.
Ellen Goodman's column also says she's the first in her crowd to blame the obesity epidemic on supersizers, from fast food to the sugar chefs at cereal companies. She's documented the burgeoning bagel, the shrinking playground, the portion out of control restaurant, as well as genes that dictate new genes, ground zero in the epidemic. Your thoughts about those comments?
Well, we know that portion sizes have started getting bigger back in the 70s and now are absolutely humongous. I mean, it's not unusual when you're eating out to get a hubcap-sized plate full of pasta, for example. And we've done a number of studies in my lab showing that the bigger the portion, the more you eat. Perhaps that's not surprising, but we just published a study a few weeks ago that showed that this effect persists. Because you might say, well, okay, I'm eating out. I am going to eat a lot because I've got a big portion, but surely I'm going to eat less at the next meal to compensate. Well, when we did our study over 11 days where we increased the portions of all of the foods available by 50%, people continued to overeat by over 400 calories a day. So over 11 days, they accumulated around 5,000 extra calories. So portion size is clearly influencing how much we eat. But it's not just big portions that are affecting what we're eating. It's big portions of foods that are what we call calorie dense. They pack a lot of calories into those portions. Big portions of things like fruits and vegetables can actually help us to eat less. because they fill us up with not very many calories. So it's this combining of big portions with lots and lots of calories packed into those that are inducing us to eat way more than we need, and the effect is very persistent. Our biology is not strong enough always to override it.
Mm-hmm. Barbara Rolls is a professor and Guthrie Chair of Nutrition at Penn State, past president of the Obesity Society, and has served on the advisory council of the National Institutes of Health's Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. So you've been in this field now for quite a few years.
I have, indeed, and I study environmental influences on food intake and how the foods we eat affect how much we eat and how full we feel, and also how they affect our body weight. So, and I've put my ideas in our studies and those of others in our field together in both the Volumetrics Weight Control Plan and the Volumetrics Eating Plan, which show consumers how to manage their weight eating a healthy diet.
If someone wants more information to follow along during the show, is there a website that they can go to find out more about your writing?
It's the volumetricseatingplan.com.
All right, volumetricseatingplan.com. If you would like to read along as we continue with Barbara Rolls, and if you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open for you at 263-1890 in Madison, or toll-free at 800-642-1234. This business of weight fashions in heft, like those in hems and heels and hairdos, change over time. Do you see us? I mean, we talk about this obesity epidemic, but is it just a transient thing where in a few years that goes away and we go back to becoming slim and trim?
If only. I mean, the problem is that being overweight or obese does carry with it all kinds of health risks, diabetes, heart disease, some kinds of cancers. And the trend now is that we're getting heavier and heavier each year. This study that we're talking about, the social networking, and that spread of obesity, they speculate that maybe it's as we see our friends as heavier, it makes us care less about our own weight or sets a standard of a different appropriate weight or appropriate amounts to eat. So as we're all getting heavier and heavier, clothing sizes get bigger and bigger, maybe we're just all going to adjust up what we think is a normal weight. And if that happens, some projections are that, you know, if we go the way we are now in 20 years or so, we're all going to have a weight problem. And the burden on our healthcare system will be enormous if that happens.
When we think about this epidemic of obesity, you look at children, and obviously that heavy children early in life can't be good as far as their future prognosis for their health. But I was kind of amazed. I noticed a little study that they asked young children to compare the taste of foods, plain, and foods carrying a McDonald's wrapper. Mm-hmm. And in almost all cases, the McDonald's food was indicated as tasting better than other foods that didn't have that kind of wrapper.
Yep, that's the power of marketing. And if only we could get those dollars and that power behind increasing consumption of healthy foods, fruits and vegetables, then we could really get somewhere. But the organizations that promote produce consumption, for example, have tiny budgets, and they can't get the marketing impetus behind them. I think we have to do that. If we don't start with our kids, we're really going to be in dire trouble, because it's really hard to change eating habits the older you get. So we need to establish them early on. We've been doing some studies where we've been reducing the calorie density of foods that we're feeding in a daycare setting to 2 to 5 year olds, and we've just completed one where we tucked extra vegetables into the red sauce on a pasta. We blended up cauliflower and broccoli, and the kids liked the vegetable enhanced version of the pasta just as much as the other version. And what happened when we served these is the kids spontaneously ate fewer calories and increased their vegetable consumption.
They just didn't feel that was something they couldn't eat, which is often the case with children.
Right. And what people tend to do, and we've seen this over and over again in our studies, both in kids and adults, is when you sit down to a mixed dish, a pasta dish or whatever, on average, you're going to eat about the same amount by weight or volume. And so if you reduce the calories in each portion, people spontaneously eat fewer calories, and they end up just as full and satisfied. And this is happening in kids as young as two, that's the strategy they adopt. So I think we as a species, we don't have a whole lot of willpower. We know what we're meant to do often, and we just don't do it. I think we need to make it easier for people to eat fewer calories and to eat a healthier diet. And that's the big goal of a lot of our research, to show people who are providing our food that they can take the calorie density down a little bit, tweak the portions a bit, and help people to eat less in spite of themselves.
Our guest is Barbara Rolls, who is professor and Guthrie chair in the Department of Nutrition at the Penn State University. Let's go to Dan in Dubuque. And Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call. How come it seems like we sugarcoat everything as far as where people don't realize that how much is genetics, you know, take a part in this, and how much is it just portion control?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously there is a genetic basis for our body weight, and we know that very clearly. There are a number of studies that show that there is a familial resemblance. For example, if both of your parents are obese, you have a much greater probability of being obese than if only one is obese or if none. So clearly there is a biological basis. The problem is that our environment has become very conducive to overeating and not exercising enough. It's just so easy to drive through and get really tasty food in huge portions that are calorie dense for almost no money. So how do we combat that? Our environment can override our biology, and I think that's a big part of what's happening, because the surge in obesity has happened very rapidly, much more rapidly than our biology could have changed.
What accounts for that?
Well, I think these changes in our environment, we've seen that the portions have increased. We're surrounded by all kinds of really cheap, good calorie-dense foods that are so easy to get, and we are becoming less and less active. We're all of us just getting more and more tied to our computers, our desks. It's getting very hard for us to get a reasonable amount of activity into our days, and we're stressed, too, you know. That contributes to overconsumption.
Mm-hmm. And the caller mentioned genetics. If my parents are overweight, am I likely to be overweight?
More likely than if they're not, sure. And if both are overweight, then your probability is higher than if just one is.
Thanks very much for the call, Dan. We appreciate hearing from you, and we have lines open. If you have questions or comments about eating, cooking, dieting, then give us a call in Madison at 263-1890 as we talk with Dr. Barbara Rolls. And if you'd like to join in, we also have the statewide line at 800-642-1234. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk with Dr. Barbara Rolls, the Helen Guthrie Chair and Professor in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the Penn State University. She's also the author of the Volumetrics Eating Plan, Techniques and Recipes for Feeling Full on Fewer Calories. Let's talk about the research that you do there at Penn State. You have the Laboratory for the Study of Human Ingestive Behavior. A rather fancy title.
Yep, and what we do is we invite people in and we feed them, and we pay them to eat. And generally what we're looking at is what foods help us to feel full and satisfied while we're trying to eat fewer calories, or what foods lead us to consume fewer calories. And we're finding that reducing the calorie density of foods has a big impact, as I mentioned in the studies in kids. The calorie density of foods is determined primarily by the water content of foods. It's really surprising because we've overlooked the impact of water in foods on how much we eat until recently. But the biggest component of our most frequently consumed foods is water. So water has the biggest impact on how much food we get to eat. And so if you eat water-rich foods, foods that are rich in fruits and vegetables, broth-based soups, you get a much bigger portion for a given number of calories than you do foods that are lower in fruits and vegetables or foods that are high in fat. Fat packs twice as many calories into a portion as carbohydrate and protein. So eating fruits and vegetables, reducing fat a little bit, can really help to fill you up with fewer calories. And we've seen that over and over again. And the great thing is that it leads to recommendations for a healthy diet, which are compatible with the dietary guidelines.
So if you drink a lot of water or eat these water-saturated foods, you have a less likely chance of adding weight than if you do if you go dry and then drink Pepsi or Coke along with the meal.
It's not that easy. So drinking water doesn't really have the same effect as water incorporated into foods. So a study that we did a few years back, we served people a first course of either a casserole, which was pretty dry, mm-hmm. or on another occasion they had a first course of that casserole and they drank 10 ounces of water along with it. And on another occasion, we cooked the casserole and the water up together to make a soup. And we looked at how much they ate then at a second course 15 minutes later. And we found that drinking the water along with the casserole had no additional effect in reducing subsequent intake in the meal. Hmm. But when you cook the water into the casserole to make this big soup, same ingredients, you reduced intake at the meal by over 100 calories. So it's water in foods, water-rich foods. And drinking water is one of the things that you're always told when you're dieting. Just drink more water, it'll fill you up, and you'll eat less. But there are no data to show that that works. Water just consumed on its own empties out of the stomach very quickly. Also, water, it tweaks completely different mechanisms in our body. Thirst is controlled by one set of mechanisms and hunger by another. But once you put the water in the food, it's going to tweak the hunger mechanisms rather than the thirst mechanisms. So it's very complex and very intriguing. But and it's not to say you shouldn't drink adequate water. Water is obviously necessary. It's healthy. It's good for us. But to count on it melting those pounds away is where you need to be careful.
In the volumetrics eating plan, the key, as I'm told, is to figure out this energy density of foods. Mm-hmm. And you can do this by using a formula, dividing the number of calories by the number of grams. Give me a couple of examples.
Okay. Well, first of all, I mean, energy density and calorie density are the same thing. So I often, when I'm speaking to the public, call it calorie density, just because energy density sounds like the higher, the better, mm-hmm. whereas calorie density, you can kind of get, well, the higher that is, the higher the calories are going to be. Well, if you look at your nutrition facts label, they always give you serving sizes in grams, and they always then give you the calories per serving. And what I would like to see ultimately is the calorie density actually on the nutrition facts label already calculated out. Every other country except for the U.S. and Canada that we've been able to find gives you calories per 100 grams, which is the same as calorie density. And it gives you a way immediately of comparing calories in portions that you're going to consume. But since we don't have that, you have to look at the labels and calculate it out yourself. But I mean, basically, calorie density can go from 0 to 9. 9 is the calories per gram for fat. Carbohydrate and protein have 4 calories per gram. In general, if your calorie density is under 1, you can eat a lot of that food, and you're not going to get very many calories. When the calories start to be twice the grams, for example, tuna in canned oil has 112 calories per 56 grams. So it has a calorie density of 2. You have to start exerting portion control because the higher the calories packed into the portions, the easier it is going to be to overeat. So since we know now from a number of studies that people tend to eat a pretty consistent weight or volume of food over a day, more consistently than calories, which is really quite strange. I mean, we've for years been studying the regulation of calorie intake when, in fact, people probably learn about appropriate amounts they should be eating in terms of what their plate looks like, how full their plate is.
Let's go to the phones and take some calls. Maureen and Hilbert, let's hear from you. What's on your mind today?
Hi there. I'm actually on the highway, so my cell phone won't cut out. I had a question about when I look at the labels for food products, I'm always amazed at all the additives and even whether they're bioengineered. And then I wonder about the things that went on to the food as it was growing or being raised and wonder if all those different additives and chemicals are being processed differently now by our bodies and allowing us to even take in the nutrients or, you know, maybe making us hungrier or anything like that.
Well, gosh, that's a really complex question because there are so many different things that now are going on with our food supply. Really not much evidence per se that that's going to be affecting your intake and your obesity rate. I mean, there have been scares that hormones added to various animal products might affect body weight, but, you know, that's still not considered serious science at this point. So very, very complex issue. Those of us who study obesity have not really gotten into that. Now, one thing that is quite interesting in terms of all of the toxins and additives that we're taking in our environment is if you lost weight really rapidly, a lot of these could get released into your body. Your fat holds a lot of the toxins that we're exposed to. And as you rapidly lose weight, some of those could get into your body. And that's a new area of study that is going on up in Canada quite a bit.
So that would be a concern.
It could be, yeah. I mean, it's no excuse not to try to manage your weight, but it's just a whole new perspective on what happens with very rapid loss of fat tissue.
Maureen?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. The number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our guest is Barbara Rolls, who is Helen A. Guthrie Chair and Professor in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the Penn State University, and the author of The Volumetrics Eating Plan, Techniques and Recipes for Feeling Full on Fewer Calories. Let's go to Archie next in Hayward. And Archie, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. Hey, I was wondering why it is that we've got these really good whole foods, natural and light on calories, high in fiber, high in nutrition, that are unprocessed. And actually, that's what makes them good for you. Why is it that those unprocessed foods are so much more expensive, typically, than highly, highly processed foods that are really bad for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the whole economics of our food supply and the obesity epidemic now is getting a lot of attention. It's just more difficult to and more expensive to grow a lot of the organic, the more natural products. And also the whole government subsidies system for years has encouraged growth of corn products, sugar products, for example. So they're very, very inexpensive. And so our food supply has changed. And the cheap food is the food full of corn products, sugar products. A lot of fat products are also subsidized. So to change that is going to take some major policy decisions, and it has to come from the consumers. You know, ultimately, if we demand things, changes will be made. But there are some people, scientists, who believe that we won't be able to feed our population on the mass scale that we need to if we try to go to the more traditional methods that we used to use.
Archie, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. And I just wondered if you had a thought about the concern that some people have about this country's rush to ethanol from corn will leave us short on corn for food. You may see that as a blessing.
Well, being the peak corn on the cob season right now, not particularly a blessing, but no. Gosh, you know, that's really outside of my area of expertise, how we're going to have these big shifts in economics. I would think it's outside of most people's area of understanding right now. I mean, obviously, as soon as you start shifting balances, there need to be adjustments across the board. I mean, it makes sense logically, doesn't it? We need alternative sources of fuel, and we're producing lots of corn, so why not use corn to keep our cars running? But where that leads us economically is beyond me and my expertise.
Let's talk about your volumetrics eating plan again. Your approach is a positive one, focusing on what we can eat rather mm-hmm. than what we should give up. Is that sort of the underlying premise?
Right, and also that you need to eat satisfying portions. You know, if you just say, I'm going to eat less of everything, and you have an empty plate, you're going to be hungry before you even start eating. As I've said, if you increase your intake of the lower calorie density food so that you have a satisfying volume of food, you will feel satisfied, and we've shown that you will spontaneously eat fewer calories. We just published a clinical trial where we had people either eating small portions, restricting their fat intake, or eating less fat but eating as much of fruits, vegetables, broth-based soups as they wanted. So they were given positive messaging, eat more of the fruits and vegetables and soups and whatnot. Both groups lost considerable amounts of weight, the low-fat group 15 pounds in 6 months, but the reduced calorie density food that was group that was eating more fruits and vegetables lost 20 pounds. They lost significantly more weight. And they were very satisfied with the diet. And their diet quality was better because, of course, they were eating more fruits and vegetables. Neither group had to count calories or fat grams. It was a food-focused approach where they were taught which foods they should emphasize. So I think focusing on I can eat this rather than the restrictive. As soon as we restrict things, we want them. That's human nature. There have been some studies done in kids. You deliberately restrict access to high-calorie foods, and, of course, immediately the kid wants it. Well, we all know adults are the same.
Let's go to Kate in Waukesha next. Hello, Kate. What's on your mind?
Well, good morning. I was thinking about the last time I took my daughter into a restaurant, and everything on a kid's menu is high-fat, high-calorie, fried. I mean, your choice is hot dog, hamburger, or spaghetti, near as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And wondering sort of how to fight to change some of that. And the second question I had was about high-fructose corn syrup. I've been hearing a lot lately that that tends to make you crave more sweets.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good question. Changing what the restaurants are offering is really tough because obviously they think they're giving families what the kids want. And that probably is true. Kids like these foods. They probably don't get them that often. At least I hope they don't get them that often on other occasions. But it does make it awkward. I think we can demand other things. I know you can special order. You can ask for smaller portions of some of the adult foods. If you think your kids will eat it. I mean, unless we as the consumers demand the changes and then buy the stuff that we've actually asked for, the restaurant industry is not going to change. Their perception is they are giving us what we want. Same with portion sizes. People like big portions. They like value. So it's a real problem. How do we change what kids like to eat, what parents think they should be eating, and then what they're offered? Because we're in this real cycle now where we keep reinforcing the liking for these high-fat foods that, I mean, almost never have any vegetables served along with them unless it's fried potatoes.
Mm-hmm. And the second question gets us back to corn.
Yeah, the high-fructose corn syrup is used a lot now, obviously, primarily in soda, but it is in quite a few other foods. It's often an economic issue. It can be cheaper than regular sugar, sucrose, which comes from sugar cane or beets. There's been a lot of questioning about whether high fructose corn syrup is more obesogenic, if it makes us fatter. And there really are no data to support that. Sucrose and high fructose corn syrup end up, after being processed by the body, is almost exactly the same mix of sugars. So, there, you know, we still don't have complete understanding, and I think that we do need to be aware that different kinds of sugars, different kinds of fats, different kinds of carbohydrates, all could have different effects in our bodies. And we need to systematically try to understand these things, particularly, I mean, the change from sucrose to high fructose corn syrup in our food supply occurred very rapidly. So I think it is good to step back and keep doing studies to try to figure out if it does have different metabolic effects, if it does have different effects on our health.
Kate, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. If you'd like to join in with your questions or comments about food, then give us a call in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Rick in Milwaukee has a question. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi. Thanks for calling. I am on a cell phone. I hope I don't break up. Two parts to my question. The first part is looking at organic foods. I go to Whole Foods quite often and buy organic. My understanding is there is a difference in organic foods, so that, for instance, you might want to buy apples that are organic, but your leaf lettuce doesn't have to be. So I wondered if your speaker could comment about that. The second part goes back to what she was just talking about, high fructose corn syrup, and if she would comment about the effects of the different types of carbohydrates. I refer to them as fiber carbohydrates versus starchy carbohydrates, and the impact on insulin production within the body.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, there are clearly are the foods that are more recommended to buy organic than others. I mean, some berries, for example, you're likely to get more benefit from buying the organic versions. You can find lists of the different foods if you just Google this kind of question. Off the top of my head, I don't remember which ones fall in which category.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the standards for organic need to be firmed up, too. That's a whole big issue now. You know, what are we calling organic? How do we define that is a point for discussion.
Right.
Okay, now on the types of carbohydrates, I mean, they're clearly now, I mean, this has been a really positive thing that's been happening in nutrition and in a lot of the diet books and the recommendations now, is this not just cutting carbs, but emphasizing your whole grains, your less refined carbohydrates as the strategy that you should adopt. I mean, this whole carb-cutting craze, I mean, fruits and vegetables are primarily carbohydrates, and they contain all kinds of nutrients that keep being discovered all the time, phytochemicals, all kinds of things that depend on the color of the fruits and vegetables. So clearly we need to emphasize healthy carbs, high-fiber foods, whole grains, manage our sugar consumption, our more processed and refined foods. And in terms of how these are processed by the body, I mean, I'm sure you've heard of the glycemic response, the glycemic index. Foods that are higher in fiber, for example, or whole grains are processed more slowly, so they cause a slower, more sustained change in the glucose in your blood. There's been a number of diet books trying to use the glycemic index as a guide for food choices for weight management. And the evidence there is really not that clear-cut. If you follow the advice to eat more fruits, vegetables, high-fiber foods, more whole grains, you don't need to try to get into the complexities of the glycemic index, and you'll still be getting the benefits that you might if you tried to follow that.
Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk about eating, obesity, foods, with Barbara Rolls, who is a professor and a Guthrie Chair in the Department of Nutrition at Penn State. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. And we'll go back to the phones with Jessica in Duluth. Next, Jessica, what can we do for you?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a question about how about people that are underweight, because I am underweight, and genetics, in my case, obviously plays a large role in that. And I'm wondering if those unhealthy foods are as much of a threat to my health as they are to people who already are obese.
Mm-hmm. Good question. If you eat a lot of saturated fat, et cetera, which the foods that you might want to eat to get you to eat more, you're going to have the same kinds of risks as somebody who's overweight. You need to eat a healthy, balanced diet just as other people do. But in terms of if you want to try to gain weight as opposed to losing weight using the kinds of things that we study in my lab, then you would want to eat foods that are higher in calorie density, because you're going to be able to eat more calories for less bulk. And indeed, this has been shown to work in hospital wards with older people where they are trying to get them to eat more calories. But you want to emphasize healthier calorie-dense foods, things like nuts, and if you're going to go higher fat, the healthier oils, the olive oil and canola. If you eat a greater variety of foods, that stimulates your appetite. Done a number of studies to show that. Eating more frequently could also help to avoid eating too few calories. This has been studied mostly in the context of the elderly, who often lose their appetite and, mm-hmm. and need to eat more calories.
Jessica, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. Let's talk just a second about the premise of the Volumetrics eating plan. We talked about it earlier, but for those people who may have just joined in, you can work out the calorie density of any given food by dividing the number of calories by the number of grams. And to use an example, a 1 ounce or 28 gram serving of a reduced fat cheese stick is worth 60 calories. Its calorie density would be 2.1, 60 divided by 28. If that math works right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is a serving of salsa that is 33 grams, a little bit more than an ounce, worth 15 calories, yields an energy density of less than 1, 15 divided by 33. And so the lower the number, the better the food, and the more of it you can consume without gaining weight.
Yeah, I mean, it's calorie density and portions go hand in hand.
Okay.
So if you're trying to reduce your calories, what you want to do is keep your plate filled to the usual level that you have experienced and learned is appropriate. And so if you choose foods that have fewer calories in a portion, you get a much more satisfying amount of food for your calorie level. And we've shown over and over again in different kinds of studies that this works. If you give people reduced calorie density foods, whether they're two-year-olds or students or older individuals, they tend to eat a reduced amount of calories, and they feel just as full and satisfied. By choosing the lower calorie density foods, in general, you're going for your sneak fruits and vegetables into your day wherever you can. Snack on them, add them to your pizza topping, sneak them into your sandwiches, eat more broth-based soups, add them to your casseroles. And if you can reduce the fat content, that helps too. The lower the fat, the bigger the portion you get for mm-hmm. a given number of calories. But I always say, don't go so low you don't like the food anymore. Because if you don't like it and you won't eat it, it won't work. And if you follow these simple strategies, tweaking your favorite foods to lower the calorie density, even a little bit can help. Even small changes can help. You will find yourself spontaneously eating fewer calories. The other thing is the timing of when you eat things. If you have a large, low-calorie density salad or soup at the start of a meal, we've shown in a number of studies that you end up eating fewer calories at that meal. You get an extra course, and you end up eating fewer calories overall. So it's kind of win-win.
That's remarkable, yeah. Mm-hmm. Win-win situation.
Mm-hmm.
Jim in Algoma, let's get you into the conversation. Hello, go ahead.
I was interested. I had open heart surgery in April and sustained a rapid weight loss of about 13 pounds. And I initially attempted to bring that back by eating fat foods.
Mm-hmm.
And through my lipid panel, all out of whack. I had never had a problem with any of the tests, and now they are extremely high. I was interested about your comment. What did you say? It was a Canadian study where they found people who had rapidly lost weight tend to accumulate body fats?
If they rapidly lose body fat, they can release the toxins that are stored in the fat into their bodies. I mean, what you're talking about is a little different. Your body is responding to the types of fats you're eating, and that's why your measured lipids are changing. If you were eating a whole lot of saturated fat, animal fat, for example, your lipid panel will change in response to that in an unfavorable way. So you need to emphasize your healthy fats, and you need, especially if you're recovering from heart disease, you need to eat a good, healthy, balanced diet. We recommend a good balance of nutrients in volumetrics. I'm a professor of nutrition. I'm not going to give you a wacky diet. You look at the dietary guidelines. If you need to maintain your weight, and certainly it is very important if you weren't overweight to start with to keep your weight up, then you could work with a dietitian. They could give you really good, sound advice on how to balance your calories and keep your energy intake up so that you are healthy in the future.
Within the Volumetrics eating plan, do you offer recipes to people?
A lot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we'll take favorite foods. For example, we have macaroni and cheese, but ours is veggie-stuffed macaroni and cheese. And we show you the original version, the traditional version, and then we show you how you can tweak the recipe by reducing the fat a bit, by adding vegetables. And so it's kind of fun. We'll show you before and after pictures and how much food you'll get for 500 calories for lunch, for example, if you eat a cheeseburger and a soda and fries compared to some of the recipes in our book. Usually eating the lower calorie density volumetrics recipes, you will get for the same number of calories at least twice, if not three times as much food by weight. So you don't have to eat that much. If it's too much food for you, then you eat less weight of food and you get even fewer calories. So.
Right. Jim, thank you so much for the call and good luck to you. Let's go, go next to Angela in Green Bay. Angela, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I've recently switched from a vegetarian to a vegan diet, and I've got to focus more on whole foods, fruits and vegetables, avoiding processed. So I'm wondering, how can I monitor my calorie density without having the labels to refer to?
Yeah, if you're eating fruits and vegetables, most of them are pretty low in calorie density. In general, your non-starchy fruits and vegetables are going to be so low in calorie density that you pretty much don't need to worry, that you can eat those in unlimited quantities, and they're going to help to fill you up and displace the higher calorie density foods. The starchy fruits and vegetables are still really healthy. They're a bit higher in calorie density, so a bit more portion control. But of course, it also matters what you add to them. So, you know, if you're going to put fat or sugar on any of these, then that's going to affect things. But in general, the research that we do and research that was done at the University of Alabama, when people are encouraged to eat more fruits and vegetables, they end up eating a healthier diet and they manage their weight really successfully. It is a problem, though. I mean, obviously, not all of the things out there in our food supply now give us nutrition information.
Yeah. Does that kind of work the same, then, for a lot of the, like, tofu and tempeh and stuff like that? Is that kind of foods that maybe should be watching calorie density with, or?
They're generally pretty low. You know, they're very high in water content. Anything that's high in water content in general is going to be reasonably low and is going to fit well with your plan. It's when you start getting into your higher fat foods, your dry foods, that you really bump up the calorie density.
Angela, good luck to you. Thanks very much for the call. And let's see if we can get Tony in from Athens. Hello, Tony.
Hello. This question is sort of related to the high fructose corn syrup question before. Since in the past couple of decades, the real cost of fruits and vegetables have gone up by about 40%, whereas the real cost of high-fat, sugary, sweet things has gone down by about 23%. And a lot of people attribute this to the way our government funds agriculture in the mm-hmm. country, or encourages agriculture in the form of the Farm Bill. Through its commodity programs, the most subsidized crop is corn, which makes corn abundant and cheap. And I wonder if the doctor has done any, contributed any research or done any advocacy on redirecting the Farm Bill to make it healthier for Americans by subsidizing fruits and vegetables rather than high fructose corn syrup. That's my question.
Well, I don't work in this area, but there are some interesting, I mean, obviously the Farm Bill and the policy has been there for a long time. When I was a kid, my dad worked for the Department of Agriculture. When we were traveling across the country, he would show me the Butter Mountains, the ships, the retired ships that were filled with grain for storage. So this has been a long-standing problem. Of course, I as a kid would say, well, why can't we just send all that food to the starving nations around the world? Well, government policy is way, way too complex for me to understand. But I can tell you, I was a speaker at a growers association last year, a fruit and vegetable growing association, and they're against subsidies for fruits and vegetables. I was really surprised. They don't want subsidies for anything. So they don't want subsidies for fruits and vegetables, but they want the subsidies to be taken away from the grain and what, the sugar. So fascinating. So there are all different points of view, and there are all kinds of lobbying groups in Washington that are hammering away at the government with their messages. But in the end, we really do need to figure out how to make fruits and vegetables more affordable for everybody. And, of course, the quality needs to be there, too.
Tony, thanks very much for that point. And for your question, Chris in Hales Corners, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was concerned myself with the rise in obesity that you've seen so suddenly in the past few decades. And I've read some stuff about a substance called casein that's found in milk. And I see it in all the like chips and stuff people eat and Doritos. And I heard that, you know, it actually has like an addictive type action on the brain when you consume it. It makes you want to eat more and increases your appetite, along with other additives I see all the time, like MSG or hydrolyzed soy protein and all that type of stuff. I was wondering if you did any research on casein and the effect it has on the appetite and stuff like that.
Okay, so we're talking about casein?
Yes.
It's just a type of protein.
Okay, but so you never heard anything about it being used as an appetite stimulant to want to make you, you know, can't stop eating them, the chips or whatever, that type of thing? Because I see it in tons of different foods, you know, uh-huh. all the time.
No, I don't know of any studies that have shown that. So, and in general, protein is thought to suppress appetite more than carbohydrate or fat, calorie for calorie. So I don't see any reason why casein would make you eat more. It doesn't in terms of the science, it doesn't make sense to me.
Chris, thank you so much for the call. Sorry we couldn't give you the full answer to your question. One last caller would be Roger in Waukesha. Hi, Roger.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, but let's move ahead.
Okay, I have a question about CHIP, which is an acronym for CHIP. It stands for Coronary Health Improvement Project, and it's an ongoing project that is taking place in Rockford, Illinois. I was just wondering if your guest has any comments or any knowledge about that. And I understand it's going to be available here in Waukesha and the Milwaukee area very soon.
Are you aware of this, Doctor?
Nope. In Pennsylvania, we have a program for feeding or medical care for kids called CHIP, but I don't know of this cardiac program. I'm sorry. It sounds like it might be regional.
Roger, thank you so much. I'm sorry we couldn't give you a full answer there as well. But thanks so much for spending this hour with us. It's been very enlightening. And again, your book is The Volumetrics Eating Plan by Barbara Rolls, R-O-L-L-S. It's published by HarperCollins. It's available as a book and I suppose also beyond that as CD or DVD?
It's on DVD now, and there's a first book, The Volumetrics Weight Control Plan, and you can find out more about the books and my lab at volumetricseatingplan.com. And thank you very much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Professor Barbara Rolls is the Guthrie Chair of Nutrition at The Penn State University and the past president of the Obesity Society. She directs the Laboratory for the Study of Human Ingestive Behavior. Our thanks to Martinez White for on-air phone production, and to Sharome Owens and Rhonda Fanning for helping to produce this show. And thank you for listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We've all heard the stereotype, women, more than men, like to talk.
They talk a lot. Talk is the glue that holds a relationship together for women and girls more than for men and boys.
But it's more complicated than just who uses more words. I'm Neil Conan, Men and Women Talking, Who Really Gets the Last Word, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.